Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, hanging gardens, great pyramids and other superstructures were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like Days of the Week and Deadly Sins, there were always seven of them. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is an American performer and writer appearing at his first show on this side of Atlantic, this year's Edinburgh Festival. The show is called What If This Is the Best I Can Do? So please welcome Matt Golditch. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, surprise. Are you guys thrilled?
Yeah. So that's right. I've understood from you this is your first show that you've done this side of the Atlantic.
This right here is literally the first show, because I'm premiering tonight is my show.
All right. So, well, it's very good of you to come along and do this. I want to let the audience into this because just the excitement of it all. You were due to be coming on tomorrow night, and somebody else had to pull out, and you very kindly come 24 ahead of time.
I'm happy to be a backup. Somebody else.
There's certainly no backup. You were going to be tomorrow.
The exciting surprise guest you wrote that intro for canceled, and you had to leave it the same, so that's fine.
The intro's the same, everyone. Don't worry about that. It is very good. So tell us the name of your show and where it's on, so we at least get that mentioned.
Yeah, it's called What If This Is the Best I Could Do? It's at the Gilded Balloon. I found out today it's pronounced Teviot.
Yes.
Teviot, not Teviot. And it's just I'm doing an hour of stand-up. So,
if I may say so, that sounds almost like a sort of British title. What If This Is the Best I Can Do? Americans.
Well, then it should crush, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you're normally Americans. Yeah, this is the best. I'm going for it. Whereas in Britain, we tend to be, I'm not sure if I'm trying to do my best.
I think I'm going to do quite well in Britain, honestly, because I'm very down on myself. So yes. It seems like the whole show, the topic is failure.
And, all right.
Yeah. So.
Well, I certainly are going to be coming along and enjoying it once it gets
good.
That's my sort of area. But let's just give us some idea of what you've done other than doing shows over here. You write comedy and you perform comedy, and you've written for quite a lot of big American
shows.
Yeah,
I mean, most recently I've been writing for Late Night with Seth Meyers for the last 9 years until we went on strike in May.
All right.
So I haven't been doing anything since then other than getting ready for this, so it better be good. I don't know, but yeah.
So even talk shows are subject to this
talk
Hollywood
show, everything,
strike.
Yeah.
Even ones that we in New York, or is it the whole
everything,
country?
Everything, New York, LA, everything is pretty much shut down.
So what's on late night television?
Reruns, and apparently they're doing just as well in the ratings, which is not good.
And how far back do you go on sort of late night? David Letterman,
I wrote for Letterman for a year, and
yes.
I got fired. I'll talk about that in my show.
All right.
And was that
because you slept with him, or because... that was the most extraordinary moment on the Letterman show.
I talk about that in my show. It actually happened. He came on the air and talked about his scandal, and that was on a Thursday. And then Friday was a rerun, and then Monday that following week was my first day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he did a whole monologue about it.
Just so everyone's up on this, because I'm a bit obsessive about these things, so I know about it. But so Dave Letterman, is a big talk show. How many years was he on? 20, 25
Something
years?
Something like that, yeah.
And then he seems to have had the odd affair with female members of his staff.
Yeah.
And somebody found out about it, so tried to blackmail him. And instead of either paying up or retreating to his shell or whatever, the whole thing was set up where the police were going to go and arrest him, the associate of one of these women, and he announced it on air, and it was extraordinary.
It was pretty wild,
yeah.
It was a good way, the blackmail was a good way to sort of throw off the other part of it, which was less less charitable towards him. But it was crazy. I mean, and he went on that first day afterwards and talked about the whole thing in my monologue. It was in his monologue. It was his first day, and my family was all like, "Did you write those jokes?" I was like, "No, I didn't write jokes about the boss's sex scandal on my first day." That was,
but because in the nature of the way he does things, you wouldn't know until you were halfway into that what he was saying, whether it was a joke or
that's very true. It was a lot of people, I think, thought that he was spinning a yarn.
I'm slightly wasting time here talking about my little anecdote of mine. It was about the David Letterman show, because I once saw a thing that he did, which I was so enjoyed, but I also was so cross with myself for being so stupid. He did a thing when he was just doing a regular show, and he noticed two sailors in the audience in sailor uniforms. And he said, "What are you? Wait, who are you guys? What are you?" "Oh, they'd just been at sea for 6 months, and they're docked in New York, and they came to see." He said, What are you doing? Come to my TV show? You should be out something much more raunchy than just seeing a TV show." So then another guest and a bit of music. He went back to, "What, you're still here? Haven't you gone off to a strip club yet?" "No, no, we loved it." And it went about four times to them. Yeah. Then eventually he said, "Oh, look, come with me. I'll take you somewhere interesting." And the camera came with him, and then they went out the back of the studio into like a strip club, you know, nightclub kind of place. Yeah. And at that point, the shot went from that camera to another camera, which was in the strip club. And that moment I realized, no, these are just actors.
Yeah.
They're not, they never were sailors, that whole thing. So in that context, to see him, I'm being blackmailed.
Wouldn't it be an amazing ending to that if I said I wrote that?
It would be fantastic.
But no, sorry to disappoint.
I think you could have done it. Timing wouldn't work out. Anyway, so you've appeared on these shows as well.
Yeah, I've done stand up on a few different talk shows. Yeah.
So are you when you're writing jokes, are you a frustrated performer at that point? Do you enjoy?
No, I get a thrill out of both. I get a thrill out of performing on stage and doing well. And then I also, when your joke does well on television, that's also very exciting.
Yes. So,
yeah, they're both fun. I like both.
But I imagine they're quite tough shows to get jokes on. There are lots of writers, high quality writers, and just getting the jokes on is quite hard.
Yeah, I mean,
work.
There's a lot, for sure, there's a lot of competition, but it's even harder when we're on strike.
That makes
it, yeah.
So, well, luckily, you'll be able to make a fortune in doing your show.
Oh, my God.
Over here.
Yeah.
For somebody used to American wages, you'll be surprised the amount of money you can get.
Yeah. I mean, I'm losing, I think, 1.25 times what I would lose in America.
So okay, like all right. Anyway, so I got you to do your seven wonders.
Yeah.
And so that's the basis of this conversation. So, and some of these are quite American, which is good to introduce us to various things. Some obviously so. But anyway, your first wonder of all the things in the world, the wonder of the world, is the Saturday Night Live sketch, The Guy Who Plays Mr. Belvedere, Fan Club.
Yes.
So
I was definitely a comedy nerd growing up. I actually, so it's funny because they, you know, when the producers reached out to me to do this, they tried to explain to me who you were. And I was like, no, I know, because I watch.
No, that did not require a laugh.
But, you know, I was a big, when I was 12, 13, I watched comedy all the time on TV. And one of the things they showed in America on Comedy Central was the original Who's Line. And it was on when I would like get home from school. So I would watch it every day.
Yes.
And so I watched a lot of that, a lot of the Simpsons, Seinfeld, and a lot of Saturday Night Live. And I have a lot of favorite Saturday Night Live sketches, but I definitely picked the one that I thought was because a lot of people have certain Saturday Night Live sketches that are famous that I also love, but I picked the one that I thought people might not know as well.
Well, I think you might have found that, but but Saturday Night Live's been on for decades, hasn't it? It's a slightly strange American institution. Our shows tend to come and go a bit here, not all of them, but most of them do. Whereas Saturday Night Live has now got people who could be the children or grandchildren.
It's almost 50 years old. I mean, it's been around forever, and I mean, it goes through, you know, but there's certain sketches just over time that always make me laugh. And this one, I remember seeing it as a kid, and it's Tom Hanks is the host, and he is hosting a meeting of the I mean, even the title is funny. The fact that it's the guy who plays Mr. Belvedere fan club. Yeah. Like, these people don't actually know what the actor's name is who played Mr. I picked, by the way, it's also, he's British, right?
Yeah, so I played. Christopher Hewitt.
Yes.
But I have to tell you, the Mr. Belvedere show is not famous over here.
It's not famous in America.
Oh, okay. And I think that was Christopher Hewitt's finest sort of most lucrative role. I don't know if he's known for anything
but
over
here.
But
you watched the sketch. I mean, everybody in this meeting is a fan of him, and every actor in the sketch is perfect as themselves. I mean, Tom Hanks is perfect as the straight man who's sort of reacting to people.
Well, that was the most exciting thing, first of all, that it's Tom Hanks.
It's young Tom
I wasn't.
Hanks,
I don't associate Tom Hanks with Saturday Night
Live.
He
hosts Saturday Night Live. And I mean, and his delivery is perfect. And keep in mind, it was delivered live. So, I mean, he sort of nails it one take. And then everyone in it is perfect. Chris Farley is in it, and he's sort of perfect. Phil Hartman. There's all these people when they were younger. Adam Sandler. And they all sort of, everyone sort of nails their one or two moments in the sketch just perfectly. And then Phil Hartman has this line that I always remember. They're talking about what you should and shouldn't do if you're a fan of Mr. Belvedere, and he said, I should want to cook Mr. Belvedere a simple meal. I should not want to cut into him, to tear the flesh, to wear the flesh, to be born into new worlds where his flesh is my key. And Tom Hanks has to say, good.
Yeah.
And just the delivery of it is perfect.
So they're obsessives, and they get more and more obsessive. So they're just fans, and these super fans, and these homicidal fans.
Right. Yeah. It's also very, I mean, I don't know how much people have been paying attention, but there's been this string in the news of like concerts where the fans are like throwing things at the performers. Yeah. And it's very relevant now, where this idea of like, oh, I'm a huge fan of this person, should I kill them? Like all these people sort of go to that natural place.
Yes,
of, like,
it's scary, especially as we tend to have a view of America that there's potential for violence seems to be around the corner, every corner.
I don't think it's just potential. I think it's realized.
And Tom Hanks is particularly good. His delivery is rather like Bob Newhart, you know, that sort of monologuist
that people are
familiar with. But I don't know if he was modeling. So, I mean, this is about 1990, was it?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah. So this is part of your history.
This was probably right in my wheelhouse. I mean, they say, right, like stuff that you got into when you were like 11 or 12 was probably like the stuff that you are a fan of for your entire life. So that definitely fell in that.
So that's your first Wonder of the World.
And that was my first, yeah.
And that is that watching that sort of thing, and of course, Whose Line Is It Anyway, did that encourage you to think, I could do better than that. I can do that.
I definitely took me several years to realize, like, I knew at that point, I love TV, I love comedy, and I sort of was like, I need to get in that into TV or into entertainment or something. Yeah. But it really took me until maybe 6 or 7 years after that, till college, or even maybe when I got to New York, to be like, comedy writer, that's where it's at.
So you went to college or to university. Did you study anything vaguely related to writing jokes?
Not really. I studied political science. But,
that's close enough.
Good for topics. Yeah. But
so did you think about being a politician or writing speeches for politicians?
The major that was closest, I knew there was a film major, but it was called Modern Culture and Media. And it was all about, the first class I took was all about Marxism. And then the second one was the intro to film class. And I think the first film that they showed us was that old film where the guy is getting his eyeball sliced open. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh,
it's like from the 20s. And I was like, I think this is not what I want to do.
Yes.
I was just sort of, this is not what I was thinking when they said
film. I thought you were going to say the first was Karl Marx and the next one was the Marx Brothers.
Yeah, that would have been a good. Yeah. Yeah. Now I might have continued with it.
So did you have a job out with the comedy or TV industry first? My
first job out of college was, I was actually a page at NBC where I work now. So I would give tours to people, tours at the studio, and then seat the audiences for various shows. So,
all right.
Yeah.
So you'd already kind of decided this was your area.
I think so, yeah, at that point. Yeah.
And what about performing? When did you first...
Also in college, I started doing stand-up. I actually got rejected from the sketch group and then the improv group. And then I was like, well, I'll just start a stand-up group. So I started that. I'd never done stand-up. But
you're more in control of that if you just decide what to say rather than
I felt that way. And people always say to me, I mean, they're always like, oh, I don't know how you get up there and perform. It seems so scary to me. And for me, it's not scary because you have a script, right? Like, I know exactly what I'm going to say and I've planned it, as opposed to improv, which some of my coworkers do, and I find that way scarier.
Well, I was just talking to Paul Merton the other day, who's an old friend of mine, who's a leading improviser up here doing an improvised show, and he says the exact opposite of you. He said, well, you know, if you've got a script, you've got to think about remembering the lines, whereas improv, you've got nothing to remember. You've just got to come up with stuff. And
Well, he's wrong.
he's right for himself. He's right
That's
for himself.
Fair. That's fair.
So was this New York when you were at college, or was it somewhere?
No, I was in college Providence, Rhode Island, a school called Brown.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a classy, university.
Yeah, you know.
And it gets mentioned in Family Guy quite a lot, doesn't it?
Does it? Yeah. I think so. Yeah, they make. Yeah, it's like sort of.
I'm sure Brian is an uncompleted PhD.
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. He's one of my favorite characters of all time, Brian, the dog from Family Guy.
Yeah. One of your seven wonders.
It probably would be, actually, sorry, I'm rambling on too much myself. There's a brilliant scene when they're trying to make Brian go back and do his PhD. And one of the ways of doing it is to get the Hoover out and running around, because dogs don't like Hoovers. Sure. Just to make him to finish a PhD. It's such a beautiful combination of things. Tell me you wrote that joke as well.
Sorry.
Okay. All right. So that's it. Saturday Night Live sketch. That's a very American, aspect of comedy for us to think about. That's good. But your next, maybe this is American as well. So your next wonder is having exactly one drink.
Yes.
So this is not normally the way we do things over here.
Right, I've noticed. Yeah.
Especially not in Edinburgh, in my experience.
I think, I just think one is first of all, I want to make it clear, I think the worst number of drinks to have is zero.
Okay.
I think but I think one, I like having one. Almost as much every night as I can. I used to be able to have two, and now I found in my 40s, I'm down to one. And I feel good after
Don't
one.
Don't try and pretend 40s is an old age. I think I can speak for quite a few people in the room. You're a young man.
I know. But I did wake up with like leg pain yesterday, just out for nothing. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But I got very into, over the pandemic, I turned 40 at 1 month before, I guess it was 3 months before everything shut down. And my wife asked me what I wanted for my 40th. And I said, I'd like the ability to just like make any cocktail at home, and just anyone who comes over, just be able to make them a drink.
All right.
And so little did I know the whole world was going to shut down for a year. And so literally I spent like a year and change just making myself a cocktail every night.
Oh, so your idea of exactly one drink is a cocktail that's full of about six different alcoholic.
Yeah. That should have been clear. Yeah. No, but I just think having a drink at night is just one of the great pleasures of my life.
Yes.
And I miss it if I don't have it. But then I've recently found that if I have more than one, I don't need it.
The weakness of the I'll just have one drink policy.
Right.
Is we've all tried to apply that.
Yes.
Because if you have one, it makes you more inclined to have the next one.
Yeah.
And the next one. And that's the whole thing about like drink driving. So you say the best thing to say, if you're at an event and you're driving home, you don't have any drinks.
Yeah.
Because once you say, well, I'll have one, you then say, well, maybe I could have two. Perhaps not in Scotland, because the drink limit is lower than it is in England. So I worry about it when I'm in Scotland. You say, well, I better not have any drinks then.
Yeah.
And in a more general way, beyond the driving thing, one leads to two leads to three. So how do you make sure you stick at the one? How do you and should we, if we're going to adopt it?
If I know I'm going to be driving, my plan is I always have to drink as soon as I get there. So you have to, because if you don't start drinking right away, then there's the chance the alcohol might be in your system. So the responsible thing to do is to just have a drink as soon as you can, so that it's out of your system.
But I quite like your style, but the idea, if I'm driving, I have to get a drink quickly.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I
think we might need to put a warning out with this particular podcast.
This man
is a comedian. He's not a public health advisor.
You hit on one of the keys, which is that you want it to be a good, stiff drink.
Yes.
Which is if you're only having one, so that you really get the most out of it. You want to make sure it's a good drink. And then, I don't know. I mean, you eat a bunch of food, so you're full, and then you're done.
Yeah. An alternative strategy is to go to somewhere where people are going to drink a lot and have nothing at all. You know, have a grapefruit juice or a non-alcoholic beer or something like that. And you somehow you get the atmosphere. The other people are doing the work to have all the alcohol to make it a jolly occasion.
Yeah.
And you've got to allow yourself to go with the thing. Don't sit there grumpily saying, "Oh, I don't get these stupid people rambling on." Just go with it. Go with the flow. That's an alternative strategy, I would suggest.
I think so. Yeah, you have to. Yeah. Otherwise, you're just going to end up eating like six ice cream cones or something to try to fill the hole. Just some sort of.
Sometimes we get the impression, I get the impression anyway, that in showbiz in America, maybe more LA than New York, that people don't drink, you know, because they don't want. I mean, British people going over there like to drink because that tends to be part of our culture. But Americans nowadays want to, you know, have a sensible diet, not too much putting on weight, and very little alcohol.
For sure, in New York, people do, especially stand-up, people do still drink before and during the show. I found that I maybe one or two sips to take the edge off is good, but I prefer to drink after the show. And by the way, it's now occurring to me that people are going to run into me after this at the bar having my third or fourth drink of the night. And I'm going to have, you know.
Oh, well, I think you just had a – you're having a bad night when they bump into you.
That's how you'll know the show didn't go well.
So when you do your show –
or it went great.
When you do your show tomorrow night, starting tomorrow night after this –
Tonight. Report, I start tonight.
Tonight. Will you have a drink before you begin or do you wait until you do –
No, for sure. Yeah.
Years and years ago, I did a radio recording, and it was in a sort of stand-up place where I'd done shows, and we always had a drink when we were doing it. And then I did it on the radio, and I heard myself. I thought, oh, no, I'm never doing that again, because you can hear – there's a sort of slight slurring in your voice. And then the other night I was asked to do a podcast, which it's called something like Three Drunk Women Talk About Crimes. And it was, fun to do. It's a good fun podcast. I thoroughly recommend it. But I had to have a drink there because that was the thing. But it was
a short one or what happened?
Well, I only had a beer. They said it was three drunk women. One of them was pregnant, so she hadn't drunk anything at all.
Sure.
So I was, I was fooled into it. But
sounds like it.
Yeah. Okay, but if they ask you to do that, it'd be a good
one to do.
Yeah, one to do. Well, so that's your second wonder done. Now, your third wonder, very much an American thing, which is NFL football.
Yeah.
So, justify
I
that.
I decided I would try to dig myself a hole and dig my way out of it. Yeah, I don't know. It's a bad thing. It's not good, professional football in America. I think it's very unethical. The people injure themselves and they suffer brain damage. It's horrible, but I can't stop watching it. It's the one sport where if I turn it on, any two teams are on at any time, and I will watch any game that's on. I don't I've told myself many times, like, oh, you know, my team, which is the Philadelphia Eagles, they won the Super Bowl several years ago, and I said, I just want to see them win one Super Bowl, and then I can give this up forever.
Yes.
And I didn't. I'm more in it than ever. I do think one of the appeals of football for me is it's on once a week. You know, I think football, what you call football, soccer, that too, where it's, what is it, twice a week, right? Where it's like...
Oh, it's on most nights now.
Right, but if you're a fan of a team, how often do they play?
They play in some parts of the season twice a week.
Right.
Yeah, which is quite a lot for the game.
Yeah, but baseball or basketball, to the other American, I mean, your team is playing a lot, and you're sort of giving up a lot of your life for it, as opposed to once a week, which seems like... But for whatever reason, it's the sport that I find most exciting to watch.
Yeah.
I can watch it at any time. I would watch it at any time.
Well, we all get brought up on whichever sport happens to be in our home or our parents or our country or whatever. But an American football, there are people who like American football over here, but it's a limited market. And it seems a very, very a sort of managed brutality compared to... The most similar game that's played a bit over here is a couple of forms of a game called rugby football.
Sure.
Rugby, which is played here, which is, you know, there's a lot of bashing into people. Well, they're not in helmets and padding, and it's not absolutely just thumping in the hole. It's getting more like that, and they're getting more injuries, like their concussion injuries.
Now you're piquing my interest.
Yes.
Maybe I'll start watching.
Well, there are two forms of it. There's a rugby union and rugby league,
yeah.
And they divided 100, you know what? This country's like, you have to go back 100 years to work out why this happened. They divided about money 100 years ago, and they've developed on slightly different lines. But they're both big, chunky guys bashing into each other.
Yeah.
Who've got bigger and bigger as the years have gone by. I don't mean they have, but
no,
the players.
Yeah. I mean, football, they keep trying to make it less dangerous, but ultimately, it's like you said, it's people bashing each other with helmets. I don't know why I enjoy it so much, but I really I can't stop watching it.
And the little bit of, well, not the little, but a particular bit about it, which we find difficult to understand, because our football in this country and indeed around the world is played on pure capitalist lines. The more money the club has, the better the players they can buy, the more money they come in from television or from the oil-rich states or Russian oligarchs when they were around. That just determines how we're... But in America, you have this draft system where the worst team gets the best pick of the players for the next year.
Yeah, I think that is part of the appeal of it. In football, there is a salary cap, so all the teams are sort of on even footing. There are other sports...
Cap's quite a big cap, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But in baseball, the richest teams tend to win more because they spend the most money.
Right.
And so it's a little bit more unfair.
So, but it just seems, I'm not saying it's a bad way of doing, but it seems a strange way looking at it from a non-American point of view that because you did so badly, you get, you know, if, I don't know, let's say Harry Kane's player has just been transferred to Germany, but you would get the right to have him in your team if he was just coming out of college.
Yeah.
Because you did the worst in the league.
It's to keep things even. Although there is, I mean, there's what they call tanking, which is, you know, teams, once they realize they're going to be bad, they start trying to be as bad as possible to get.
All right.
Another pick. Yeah.
But that's not a very good, that's not very good for the sport, is it? That people are not trying.
I told you I was embarrassed to be a fan. Yeah.
So how often has your team, you know, won?
They won the Super Bowl 5-6 years ago, yeah. And it was one of the most exciting things of my life. And then they made it to the Super Bowl last year, and they lost in very heartbreaking but exciting fashion. But they have a young, up-and-coming team. They seem like they're primed to only get better.
Okay.
Which I'm fully
We all
in.
Say that about our team.
I know, right? So,
We're building for the future.
But I mean, but also, like, I will, like, if a game is on between, like, the two worst teams in the league and I have nothing else going, like, I will watch it happily, and it's the one, well, I'll get into it. I'll find a way to get
it. I know. It's a great time. Not NFL, but watching football is a problem with me. I waste a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
But there it is. So your NFL football, it's very popular in North America. It hasn't spread around the world the way some other forms of football had. That's the only thing I would note.
No, I know. Yeah.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, your fourth wonder... I'm hoping to pronounce his name correctly. Tom Breihan's stereo gum column, The Number Ones.
Yes.
So the way, as you can tell, I'm picking my way through that. I'm not super familiar with this, and perhaps I should be.
He's a writer for Stereo Gum, which is a music website. And during the pandemic, I started reading his columns. I wish I knew the name. He got the idea from an English writer who started writing a column about every single song that had ever been a number one hit in the UK, and then he decided to basically take the idea and do it about every single song that had ever been a number one hit in America. And he was, for a while, he was writing three a week, and he started at the beginning of the Billboard chart in like 1958, 1959, and he's now up to like Katy Perry, he writes a column about every single song. And I started reading it a few years ago. At the time, he was like in the late 80s, I later went back and read all the old columns, and I've read every new column since.
Yeah.
And it's kind of become it hits a lot of the sweet spots for me, which is music, but also lists,
yes,
and records,
yeah,
and statistics and things like that. But he also just has a way of writing about the songs where he tells you all the important information about the history of it, the making of it, but then it's also a personal connection to it. And then he gives it at the end a rating on a scale of 1 to 10 of why he likes it. And it's also given me a new appreciation for a lot of forms of music that I necessarily didn't always love. Like, I definitely grew up listening to a lot of rock music, classic rock, alternative rock. And I've sort of, you know, I've now gotten belatedly like very into like Janet Jackson and Mariah Carey and things like that, where they've been hugely popular over the years, but I never necessarily liked them. And I now find myself wanting to listen to them.
Just because you've been taken through them. And
I think that sort of, it took me on a little bit of a, like a ride through, like listening to some, you know, he's a very good writer in that he's a rock writer, I think is his background, but he has an appreciation for a lot of different forms of music that aren't necessarily critically popular, like disco or like straight up just pop music.
Yeah.
You know, he really, stuff that's been sort of like critically derided over the years, but like very popular. And so it's given me a new appreciation for it through that.
Well, the first thing I would say to that, and you're not really supposed to gender things so much anymore, but that's such a, I think it's a very male attitude thing. You mentioned the music and the lists.
Yeah.
Teenage boys love, or when you had records.
Right.
Loved arranging their records, their singles, their LPs, their albums, their EPs in alphabetical order.
Definitely the movie High Fidelity.
Yes.
And the book
hits
that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's, for sure.
So that's something, but it's to make it a wonder of the world. It's obviously been a big impact on you.
I get very excited when this column comes out. It used to be three times a week, and now he does it once a week. And I sort of count down the minutes to when I know it's coming out, and then I read it like as soon as I have a chance.
But it's a reading thing, because a lot of stuff online you can go onto
it's reading, music. And then you read the column, and then within it he puts the links of the video and different songs that sort of relate to it and sometimes he'll write about the song that finished number two behind it or other songs by that cover version. So there's a lot of like music history in there.
Sure.
It's really fascinating.
And of course, I suppose you discover with American number ones the same as British number ones that, you know, you think of, oh, 70s, oh, that was all punk. And then there'll be, I don't know, Clive Dunn, well, there's no one less like Granddad. And I don't know if I'm getting the era right. There's all sorts of novelty records and old forms that are, you know, Cliff Richard has a big hit or something. These may not mean much to you, but there are these big stars of different forms of music popping up.
There are a lot of, like, you think of things as certain periods that were popular, but I mean, you know, like, for instance, like you think, oh, once Nirvana broke, like that totally got rid of like hair metal.
Yes,
and it definitely did not. Like there was stuff like after that was like horribly cheesy that became popular.
Yes.
That was.
You know. I don't know if the British version you're thinking of is exactly this, but you know the musical writer Tim Rice and somebody else used to do books about you know, all the charts and the music generally. I don't know if it was just number one. So perhaps if I had slightly more time to prepare myself for you, I would have discovered that out. So I'd have to suggest, whoa, then he's just copied an idea, but why not? Because it's they're American number
ones.
Good
idea.
Yeah, obviously about 70% would be exactly the same records, but
right.
Could you obsessively get the British version as well and then compare the analysis of the overlaps? Would that appeal to you?
It would be interesting there are some songs, it's funny how there are some songs, both there are British songs that were popular in America, there were British songs that were only popular in Britain, then there were Americans that translated to Britain. There are Americans that never translated to Britain. And then there's like Americans that were only popular in the UK, but not in America. There's all these different like weird formulations of it.
Or even some band like Blondie, I think I'm right in saying they made it. I know they were in New York first, but then they came to Britain and they became big
but
stars.
But then there's other bands like Aha, which like in the States, they're like a one hit wonder. And I guess over here, they were huge or something. I don't know. They're like that. Maybe I have the wrong one, but there are other ones where they
I think they're, Aha, are they Norwegian or something?
Something like that.
So they're big in Norway.
Yeah.
And they're probably big here as well.
I'm big in Norway as well. It's not hard. No, I
don't. So your fifth wonder, Color by Numbers.
Oh, yeah. Coloring by Numbers. Yeah. So So I have two kids, and I like there are only certain certain things about that I like to do when I'm playing with them. Okay. My wife is very good at like coloring. Just like my daughter will be like, you know, can you draw something like a giraffe? And she can just sort of draw. And I like those color by numbers books where you fill in the numbers.
Yes.
And each one, and at the end it looks like a picture. Again, I think is it right brain or left brain that is like, I forget which one is.
Which brain are you talking about?
It's like math oriented or sort of like left brain. Yeah, it's like completing a puzzle.
Thank you very much.
You know, like I like to build the Lego set with my son that where at the end it looks like something. I don't like where you just throw a pile of Legos on the ground and then it's like, let's build something out of it. Like, I'm just like, no, that doesn't sound fun to me. But I really find during the pandemic, you know, we spent a lot of time with the kids and I found the color by numbers very calming, very relaxing.
Yes.
It takes your brain off of it gives you a topic or like it gives you a task to complete that does not involve your phone. You put it away and you finish it and you just sort of, and at the end you're done. You've made something.
Is this just not a way of doing artwork in an easy way?
Yes.
That doesn't require much effort on your part.
Exactly. It's if you're a non-artistic person
so
and you
want.
So
it's not painting by numbers. It's parenting by numbers.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. I would paint by numbers.
So I forced that in and it wasn't worth it as it
turned
out.
No, it was fine. But, I got it. Yeah. I don't know. For whatever reason, it gives me pleasure. I enjoy it. I might have done it like 20 minutes right before you guys asked me to give my seven wonders at the time. I don't know, it's funny because you know you go and look in shops for like presents for your kids and I see them and I get excited. I'm like, ooh, I would like that. I would do that one. Yeah.
And what is your children's attitude? Is they, oh goody, we're going to do painting by numbers again, or is it, oh no, we're doing painting by
no? It's sort of like, let's sit around
get
the table,
get the Lego out because we like throwing that around. So in the morning when you walk in and you haven't got any shoes on, and that's the best bit of playing with Legos.
Oh my god,
your parents swear
finding them. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like one of those things where everybody, you sit around the table, everybody does their own thing, and some people just want to color or paint, and some people want to color by numbers, and I'm usually the one person coloring by numbers.
So as a parent, is your trade and occupation a good one? Are you available during the day to be with your children, and you're out at night doing stand-up, or are you shut away in a room somewhere trying to be quiet, trying to write some stuff for somebody else?
Well, definitely the last few years, there's been a lot more between the pandemic and then the strike. There's been a lot more hands-on parenting than I thought there would be when I became a parent. But that's it, you know. No, I try to. It is funny, usually the dad has it's sort of the stereotype is like the dad is the fun one and the mom does all the work. And I'm the one who's sort of like, hey, I'll be over here washing the dishes. Why don't you play with them?
All right.
But I'm like, at least I'm helpful, right?
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yes, the traditional theory is that when a couple have children, the mother becomes more and more responsible and becomes more and more of a grown up, looking after things, and the husband, the father, quite often gets more and more childish because he can then play all the games that he's remembered playing as a kid. But that's the stereotype.
Well, I'm glad I've broken that gender mold by becoming extremely boring.
Okay.
That's sort of my plan. Yeah.
Okay. So that's coloring by numbers.
I think I know what the next one is, by the way. And if you thought it was boring, then you're going to really like this next one. Yeah.
So six is nectarines.
Yeah.
No.
Well, it's summertime. And I just like... I get excited for like when fruits are in season, like plums or nectarines in summer, and I just think a great nectarine, like if you eat I feel like eating a cookie or a piece of cake or brown or some sort of dessert, like it's like how could it not be good, right? Like it's almost like cheating, like there's a bunch of sugar, like you put everything in it but like a piece of fruit, like a nectarine, it's kind of more magical. Like it comes out of the ground and it just tastes great. Like how did they do that? Like isn't that cool? Or on a tree, you know? It's like it's crazy.
I don't know I don't know how many people in the audience is Scottish. Traditionally, Scotland turns its nose up at fruit and vegetables.
It's very hard to find. Oh boy.
Well. I often as a defense mechanism, I often bring up that I come from a Scottish family, and other people who are Italian or French family, they bring all these. When in London, when I was being brought up, my father would bring back the delights of Scotland, which is iron brew, which is the exciting sugary drink,
yeah.
or Scotch pies, which are made out of mince. He never brought any fruit back. But anyway, nectarines. Why? You like fruit, but why nectarines?
I just think it's, you know, if you get a good nectarine in the summer, it's just a perfect bite. You just bite into it, and it's just very refreshing. And it's I like the idea that, like, it gives you something to look forward to all year, you know, because an apple, you can kind of get a good apple, but a banana, you can get it year-round. But one that only that, you know, you can only find it in the summer is just, I think that's, you know, and I get it, you know, they show up in the supermarket all of a sudden, you go, oh, it's nectarine, or it's plum season. And I'm going to get a bunch of those.
So nectarines, they're just peaches with a smooth skin.
Oh, that's the other thing I meant to mention is that I really don't like the fuzzy skin on the peach. And so the nectarine is really...
I like the fuzzy skin on
the
peach.
Oh, you do?
But I don't know. This is going to sound weird, isn't it? But
There's something about eating it raw, that fuzzy skin that is just gross to me. I like a peach pie.
Yes.
I like when you or a sliced peach when the peaches are in the pie, but then that something about eating biting into that fuzz is gross. It feels like eating a kiwi with the skin on or something.
I think.
But you like that?
I think you're very much a man of your time.
Okay.
I think we are more used to the fuzzy skin
in my
day.
Oh, I get where you're going.
So but it's
you're online, you're searching for vintage nectarine.
I like flat peaches. Do you have those? They're being round.
The donut ones? Is that what?
I discovered them. Well, for me, they were a discovery about 5 years ago, and they're easier to eat and they're tasty.
They're good,
eat.
But they're still fuzzy, right?
Yes,
yeah.
definitely.
Okay. Well, you're into what you're into.
Push you off your nectarines.
No, okay, yeah.
So do you grow? I don't know.
No.
I don't know what your home conditions are. If you were from California, I'd expect you to have a great... But in New York, you might have a window box.
No, we don't grow anything. But we have access to... You can get them in the supermarket, but also then we have the farmer's market, you know, you go to and you get fresh peaches and the fresh nectarines and plums and things.
Yes.
And it's exciting.
Okay. So, and above all any other wonders in the world, and above all fruits, the nectarine is your king.
The nectarine, yes. But also just the example of, I just love that fruit just tastes like that.
Yes. Yeah, I think I've got
that. It's one ingredient.
Yes. And would you make, is it always just fresh nectarine, or would you turn it into a nectarine pie or something like that?
I wouldn't make a nectarine pie, but then I also, when I got into the cocktail making, sometimes I would like to have certain fruits around, and, you know, like it'd be nice to have, like, if you have a grapefruit, you can make a cocktail with that. The fresh
cocktail
grapefruit.
With a fruit is
always
good fun.
Yeah, especially in summer. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Right. So we're just about a good enough time to come to your seventh, your final wonder, which is the Trip movies.
Yeah. So those are from here, from the
indeed,
UK.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
I discovered these, and I have I love them all. There's how many? Four or five?
Something like that. So this is Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon.
Yeah.
And they did a trip around the north of England.
Yeah.
And then they went to Italy. I think
there's
did
a Greece one,
yeah.
Spain.
Spain.
So and they're all hilarious.
Yeah.
And so I know a little bit about Steve Coogan. He's sort of been in some American movies.
Yes.
And then I saw like Philomena or something. I know nothing about Rob Brydon, but I've, other than these movies, and I've purposely decided not to investigate any of their past comedy because I like these movies and I like them so much in like a capsule.
Yeah.
And I laugh at them so much and they're referencing things that I don't understand or don't know what they are, and I kind of enjoy that in a weird way.
You don't. So when they mention, you know, Alan Partridge,
yes,
you don't know
never seen. I have to say, I did look into trying to find Alan Partridge, and it's not streaming anywhere. And you can order DVDs, and I've heard it's hilarious, but I almost kind of. I like knowing that there's a thing out there that I would like that I haven't seen.
There's quite a lot of it because if you go
onto
the BBC iPlayer, I almost guarantee it's available in one of those. So he
could watch it here more easily than I could in the States. Maybe I could find it.
So he's a talk show host. He started on radio. He started as a sports reporter in a comedy world.
Yeah.
He was a pretend sports reporter. Then he got his own talk show on radio, and then it went on to television, and then he got it taken off, and then they make another series about his life when he's getting no work, really, and then he's come back again, so he's got another series back on the television, and I used to think it was funny, but unfortunately for me, it's just like watching a documentary of my life. So it's...
yeah.
But he's brilliant. He's a brilliant actor. He brings higher acting skills than is strictly required for that. He's so into playing that part, and he's done a lot of other things.
Are those movies, the Trimleys, are they popular here?
Yeah,
are
I like them. Does everyone like... And Rob Brydon...
Really?
I would say not everybody would know them, but everybody... does follow them, I think, would enjoy them. So, and Rob Brydon is another actor and comedian, and they're both can do lots of impressions, as you can obviously see from that.
Right.
And he's done lots and lots of stuff, but he now does quite a lot of quiz programs, panel shows on the television, which he's very good as well. But so there's a little bit of banter about that.
The movies all reference the fact that one has been slightly more successful than the other, and it's about the relationship and the competition of them, and then they compete sort of on these impressions to see who can do, and then they sort of, their relationship goes through ebbs and flows over the course of the movies, where sometimes they're really getting along and other times they're not, and then, you know, the impressions are always hilarious, and sometimes it's impressions of people that I obviously know and can really appreciate
you
the impression.
Michael Caine,
and then even America, they do impressions of Americans, you know, and then sometimes it's impressions of people that I don't know, and I enjoy that.
Yes.
I don't know.
No, they're both very successful.
Yeah.
You could say that Steve Coogan has done some higher. Yeah. But Rob Brydon, for example, is in the Barbie movie. I think he's only in one tiny little scene. Has anyone seen the Barbie movie?
Yeah. I have.
Did you notice him in it?
Yes.
Is it a good scene?
I want to see it. I haven't gotten a chance to see it.
Because an interview in the paper today, when you say, I don't know why people say, why shouldn't I be in the Barbie movie? Because it's a big movie. I could be in that. Just because I do Would I Lie to You, which is a very popular... and he's great on that. So, but I agree with the joy of it is you're not always sure on these trips whether they are making it all up and just pretending to dislike each other at some points, or they actually are annoyed with each other.
Yeah.
And it's a love-hate relationship.
And you get to see, like, beautiful scenery around the world and delicious-looking food and sort of, like, you know.
And you're happy to watch that as a performer and not be jealous that they have managed to work out a gig that requires them to eat luxury meals in exotic locations and to be paid for it.
Well, they're usually also having some sort of argument or some sort of... life crisis. So I feel like if that's the price, then I'd rather just be at home in my apartment.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting that should make it to be one of your seven wonders. But thank you very much for coming up with the seven. But I have to now decide which is the wonder of wonders, which is the wonder that I'm going to select of all those. I think I might be a bit parochial on this. I've been interested by all your American things. I was very pleased to be introduced to Saturday Night Live sketch and seeing Tom Hanks in action in a comedy like that. But and Nectarines, they sound good.
I feel like if I had said Peaches, you might have...
I was just trying to inject a bit of controversy in the fruit department.
Yeah.
I am getting a bit broken. I think the very last one, The Trip, I want to make that your wonder of wonders.
Oh, good.
So thank you very much, Matt Golditch, for sharing your wonder of wonders with us. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. If you enjoyed this episode of My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you found us. Thank you for listening.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.